Welcome to the Audio Digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for January 2016. This month, our topics include a request for abortion by a woman with major depression and psychosis. We'll also present an update on prescription opioid abuse and consider questions about MRI findings of neuropathology underlying psychiatric illness. Our original research studies focus on predicting response to antipsychotic drugs from baseline striatal functional connectivity, the association between obesity and ADHD, and amygdala hyperactivity during autobiographical recall as a possible trait marker of depression. This article has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll start the January highlights with our treatment in psychiatry feature. It presents the case of a woman with major depression with psychotic features. She discontinued her antidepressant before conception, and at 23 weeks gestation, she developed delusions and suicidal impulses to jump out her apartment window. She was hospitalized and requested an abortion. Benjamin Brody and colleagues relate that after resumption of her antidepressant, along with an antipsychotic, the patient regained the capacity to provide consent to the procedure, but she elected to carry the fetus to term. Time is critical in such a case. The patient's request for pregnancy termination came only a week before the end of the period in which abortion was legal in her state. The hospital's legal affairs department was asked to help determine whether the patient's husband could give surrogate consent at the end of the 5-day period in which the decision had to be made. Statutes on surrogate consent vary by state. A minority forbid surrogate consent for abortion. In these states, statutes may allow a patient or her surrogate to petition a court for access to abortion even if her capacity to give informed consent isn't restored. Another concern is the role of treatment. The goal broadens from simply alleviating the patient's depressive symptoms to attempting to restore capacity as rapidly as possible. It may be desirable for the final capacity determination to be made by a psychiatrist other than the treating physician to protect the therapeutic alliance. There may be fluctuations in both a pregnant woman's desire for an abortion and her capacity to give informed consent. The clinician must balance the primacy of patient autonomy with the physician's obligations to treat depressive symptoms and prevent patients from impulsive action based on irrational cognitive distortions. Next, we'll look at prescription opioid abuse and its treatment. Unintentional overdose on prescription opioids increased almost fourfold from 2000 to 2010. Kathleen Brady and colleagues point out that in the majority of deaths due to prescription opioid overdose, use of multiple prescribed and illicit substances is implicated. Benzodiazepines are the most common. The risk of opioid overdose increases with male gender, higher prescribed opioid dosages, inappropriate prescribing, and a substance abuse history. Methadone is also linked to a high proportion of overdose deaths. Prior to opioid therapy, patients should be screened for abuse potential. There are several validated screening tools. Patients who start opioid therapy should be monitored with particular attention to escalating use and negative impact on functioning. Treatments for prescription opioid use disorders often follow those for other opioid use disorders. They typically involve medically supervised detoxification, followed by maintenance with opioid substitution. The two most common substitution therapies are methadone and buprenorphine. The Prescription Opioid Addiction Treatment Study is the largest randomized controlled trial of treatment for prescription opioid use disorders. It examined different intensities and combinations of counseling and buprenorphine naloxone treatment. Better outcomes were associated with longer medication treatment and a slower medication taper. Treatment of pain in individuals with addiction disorders doesn't differ significantly from treatment in non-addicted people. Those with substance use disorders are at greater risk than the general public for accidents and injuries associated with pain. Untreated pain can also be a significant trigger for relapse. The goals of treatment are reduction of pain and restoration of function. For chronic pain, initial treatment is non-pharmacological. The mainstays of medication for chronic pain include non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, tricyclic antidepressants, and anticonvulsants. Even when medications including opioids are considered necessary, the treatment plan should be multidimensional. When opioids are used for patients with addiction disorders, consider frequent monitoring, pill counts, a smaller supply of medication, and incorporation of family members. It's important to document the functional benefits. Using a standardized approach can make it easier to justify decisions about opioid use and dosage increases. Medication agreements that reinforce the patient's responsibility and clarify the boundaries of treatment can help avoid misunderstandings and clarify decision points. Next, we'll look at a methodological issue in brain research. Daniel Weinberger and Eugenia Radulescu suggest caution in accepting findings from research using magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI. Its widespread use has led to a wealth of structural and functional anatomical findings in patients with diverse psychiatric disorders. The findings may represent insights into pathobiology. Popular MRI techniques include structural MRI, resting state functional MRI, and diffusion tensor imaging. Recent technical reports indicate that data from these studies are highly sensitive to common artifacts such as head motion and breathing effects. Other important confounders of MRI data include smoking, body weight, medical comorbidities, psychoactive drugs, alcohol, and mental state. These tend to vary systematically between patient and control groups, so the evidence that findings are neurobiologically meaningful is inconclusive. The concerns about MRI findings include both structural and functional anatomical differences between ill and well samples. However, in principle, so-called activation paradigms using functional MRI offer some implicit reassurance and control. In these studies, subjects are their own control, and one cognitive state is compared with another. The functional MRI studies that raise concerns analogous to those for the structural studies are the ones that don't employ a within-subject reference state. These are the so-called resting state fMRI studies. Subjects lie in the confining and noisy environment of the MRI scanner doing nothing. The activity typically seen in healthy subjects is called the default mode network. Patients with a variety of psychiatric diagnoses have been observed to have deviations from the default pattern, and it's often stated that they show a deficiency or abnormality of the default network. In fact, it's unimaginable that patients with schizophrenia or depression or autism will experience the MRI environment analogously to a paid healthy volunteer, and it's unlikely that they will each experience it the same. Indeed, an analogous so-called abnormality has been demonstrated in healthy subjects who are instructed to vary what they attend to during the resting state. Neuroimaging studies in psychiatry research have reached a crossroads. Uncritically accepting findings that may represent fallacies of all sorts carries the risk of misinforming practitioners and patients about biological abnormalities underlying psychiatric illness. Now we'll turn to ADHD and its relation to obesity. Impulsivity and inattention related to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder may increase food intake and consequently weight gain. However, findings on the association between ADHD and obesity or excess weight are mixed. Samuela Corteza and colleagues conducted a meta-analysis to examine the relationship. 42 studies were identified. A significant association between obesity and ADHD was found for both children and adults. The overall prevalence of obesity was increased by about 70% in adults with ADHD and by about 40% in children with ADHD compared to those without the disorder. Prior work suggested that the association between ADHD and obesity is influenced by gender. This meta-analysis did not show a significant effect of gender. In addition, study setting and age group did not moderate the link between ADHD and obesity. Data on both medicated and non-medicated participants with ADHD were available from a subset of the studies. The association between ADHD and obesity was significant for unmedicated, but not for medicated individuals with ADHD. The authors also examined the relationship of ADHD to excess weight in general, including both obesity and lesser degrees of excess weight. This was also significantly related to ADHD. The next study is about predicting response to antipsychotic drug treatment. Deepak Sarpal and colleagues recently demonstrated that successful antipsychotic drug treatment alters resting state functional connectivity of the striatum. Now they present a study in which they tested whether intrinsic striatal connectivity patterns provide prognostic information and can serve as a potential biomarker of treatment response to antipsychotic drugs. The authors used functional MRI to develop a prognostic index in a discovery cohort of patients with first-episode schizophrenia. The patients underwent resting state fMRI scanning at the start of randomized controlled treatment with a second-generation antipsychotic. Whole brain functional connectivity maps were generated for each subject from striatal seed regions. Clinical response was also determined. It required sustained improvement over two consecutive study visits. A total of 91 regions functionally connected with the striatum provided significant prognostic information. From these regions, an index of striatal connectivity was created that had high sensitivity and specificity. It comprised functional connections of the striatum that predicted treatment response. The striatal connectivity index was then tested on a generalizability cohort of patients. These patients had chronic psychotic disorders and were hospitalized for an acute psychotic episode. The index predicted response to antipsychotic treatment in these patients as well. It provided significant separation between responders and non-responders. In addition, the prognostic index correlated with the length of hospitalization. We'll conclude with a study of a possible trait marker for depression. In healthy individuals, the recall of autobiographical memories is biased toward positive events. Individuals with depression have a bias away from positive memories. So they're less likely than healthy controls to recall a positive memory in response to a positive or neutral cue word. Kimberly Young and colleagues examined amygdala activity during autobiographical memory recall as a putative mechanism underlying biased memory recall and depressive symptoms in currently depressed adults. The patients were compared with healthy control subjects and with two vulnerable populations, individuals remitted from depression and otherwise healthy individuals at high familial risk of developing depression. The participants underwent functional MRI while recalling autobiographical memories in response to emotionally valenced cue words. Amygdala reactivity and connectivity with anatomically defined amygdala regions were examined. During positive recall, the depressed participants showed significantly decreased left amygdala activity compared with all of the other groups. And left amygdala activity correlated significantly with depression severity in the depressed participants. In addition, they had less connectivity of the amygdala to regions of the salience network than the other groups. During negative recall, the depressed participants, as well as the remitted and at-risk individuals, had significantly greater left amygdala activity than the control subjects. The depressed participants also showed increased amygdala connectivity with the salience network during negative recall. These findings suggest that left amygdala hyperactivity during negative autobiographical recall is a trait-like marker of depression, as both of the vulnerable groups showed activity similar to that of the depressed group. Amygdala hypoactivity during positive autobiographical recall is a state marker of depression, as it manifested only in the participants with active disease. Treatments targeting this amygdala hypoactivity and blunted salience during positive autobiographical recall could exert antidepressant effects. This concludes our audio highlights of the January issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles, including author affiliations and financial disclosures. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psych.org. Next month, our topics will include the dose-response relationship of SSRIs in depression, the effects of maternal depression, SSRIs, and benzodiazepines on infant neurobehavioral functioning over the first postnatal month, and the comparative effectiveness of clozapine and standard antipsychotic treatment in adults with schizophrenia. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.